Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dwayne Dworsky. I am your host for this morning's show. Johnny Tan is not able to be here due to a family emergency. I would like to welcome everyone to the weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk radio show. My guest for this morning is Dr. Pamela Weibel. She is the pioneer of the first community-based medical clinic in America. Her new book, Pet Goats and Pap Smears, 101 Medical Adventures to Open Your Heart and Mind, reveals that a visit to the doctor can actually be fun and a joyful experience. Her model is featured in the Harvard School of Public Health newest edition of Renegotiating Healthcare, Resolving Conflict to Build Collaboration, a textbook examining major trends with the potential to change the dynamics of healthcare. Dr. Weibel and I will be discussing her latest book and how we can help in her creation of an ideal clinic where the doctor puts you in charge. Good morning, Dr. Weibel, and welcome to My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing excellent. How are you?
Good. That's great. Pleasure to have you here with me this morning. Pet Goats and Pap Smears, 101 Medical Adventures to Open Your Heart and Mind, is an amazing and entertaining and enlightening book. The book cover is outstanding and makes you wonder what's inside. Punctuated with brilliant illustrations and important details for patients and doctors, the book is an easy and fun read. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a joy to write. And I actually included a lot of the community in the production of the book. So it was a collective experience.
I'm sure it is. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present.
Well, I'm a physician who was born into a family of physicians. Both my parents are doctors. My mom is a psychiatrist, and my dad is a pathologist. And he worked as the city medical examiner in Philadelphia. And because I didn't have child care and my parents were workaholics, I basically ended up at work with them as a child.
Oh.
So I was raised in the morgue, essentially. I was around death, obviously, and I became very comfortable with the human body and disease, and I learned to interview patients at a very early age because my dad introduced me as a doctor in training at his other positions. He worked as a city police surgeon, which was at the fire department and the police department before breathalyzers. They actually had doctors interviewing the drunk drivers. So he actually let me do that with him, you know, when I was a child.
Wow.
The drunk drivers didn't mind. I think they thought I was entertaining, you know, be interviewed by a six-year-old at the police station. That's pretty fun for everyone.
Sure, why not?
And I think he also worked at a methadone clinic with heroin addicts recovering. And again, I think they thought I was entertaining, you know, to have a six-year-old examine your track marks and and discuss your recovery with you and ask the kind of questions a six-year-old would ask, you know. I think it just made the medical care just more humane and lighthearted versus serious and scary.
Oh, all right.
You know, with a child in the room.
So you were like about 6 years old when you decided to be a doctor?
I think it was in my blood from day one. I mean, when my mother was carrying me, you know, before I was even born, she was on her ER rotation. So I think I was a bit saturated in the medical field.
You were infused with Dr. Medicine.
Yes, I was.
What was the inspiration behind Pet Goats and Pap Smears, 101 Medical Adventures to Open Your Heart and Mind?
Well, I wanted to celebrate the beautiful relationships that I have with my patients, because so much of what's written in the mainstream media and what people talk about regarding healthcare is uninspiring and actually sort of scary for people, the whole idea that they might not have health insurance or they might not get health care or we can't afford it, or, you know, all the things that we read about that come out of D.C. they're not very inspiring. And so we're losing track of the actual beauty of this profession. Mm. And what's interesting is that I have a lot of medical students and residents who rotate through my office, and they often tell me, wow, you're the first happy doctor we've ever met.
Happy doctor.
And they'll say as well, you're the first solo doctor we've ever met. We've been told in medical school that's not possible anymore. And so I realized that there was a hunger among medical students and young physicians for this type of practice in which they could really have deep, intimate, beautiful relationships with their patients. And so to make this accessible, because certainly I can't bring every single medical student from around the country to rotate through my office, mm-hmm. I thought, well, let me write a book that makes this accessible for everyone so they all know that you can have that Marcus Welby relationship with your doctor in 2013, and solo doctors are possible, and happy doctors exist, because so many people don't have positive experiences with their physicians.
Wow. You have an intriguing title for your book, but why pet goats? What does this refer to?
Well, the pet goats actually came up in Citizen Testimony, the clinic that we've designed here in Eugene, Oregon, which is the first in the country, was created entirely by patients. I quit my assembly line medicine job, which most doctors are sort of trapped on a production line. You might feel that way when you go to the doctor, that you're just a number. And so I wasn't content practicing medicine in that fashion. I wanted to actually be a healer and a real doctor with my patients, not just a factory worker. And so I decided, because the patients were equally as unhappy as I was in that model, I decided to hold a series of town hall meetings throughout my city and invite the community to design their own medical clinic. And I, over 9 town hall meetings, collected about 100 pages of written testimony, and I was able to adopt 90%, and we were open just 1 month later. And what's fascinating is people continued to give all sorts of analogies about pet goats and wanting to bring animals with them to the medical clinic. And I just thought it was funny. but when I came up with the title, I decided to actually mine the testimony that I received from community members. And pet goats was one of the, I know it's hard to believe, but that's
all
one
right.
of the things that they brought up. They wanted to... I think they just want to have a down-home, you know, this is Oregon, not Manhattan, okay?
Yeah, that's
so
true.
They wanted to have a relaxed, normal, you know, hangout on the farm kind of experience with their doctor. They don't want it to be sterile and scary and in a big
And it's
building.
A real eye-catcher, too.
Yeah, and so it's a fun title. I obviously do a lot of pap smears, so that's where that came from. I provide a lot of women's health services, and so it just has a nice ring to it. And then the goat actually lives just down the street from me and came to my office for the photo shoot. It's not photoshopped. And the stethoscope, I had to cut down to a goat size, you know, so it's a little shorter. And the medical student in the background, she's a 28-year-old medical student out of Chicago who's on the cover. So yeah, it took 3 photo shoots with the goat at 6 in the morning in my office to come up with that beautiful cover with the right model there.
Sure is. Can you please give us a synopsis of your book?
Well, the book is 101 medical adventures that I've had with patients, primarily over a 20-year medical practice in family medicine. And so the book celebrates the beauty of my patients' lives. And actually, the last section, which is a section called Death, I divide the sections into, you know, love, joy, creativity, intuition, death, these sorts of things. These are all topics that are not taught in medical school. Amazingly enough, they don't teach us anything about death in medical school. And it's kind of, it's not a popular topic.
Part of life.
Considered failure, you know, if your patient dies. And, you know, they don't teach joy or love or the value of intuition, you know, the things that actually happen when you're sitting with a doctor who pays attention. You know, this is like the humanity of being a doctor. And so I created a book that would celebrate the beauty and the humanity of medicine, not just, you know, the technology that they learn in medical school or the procedures.
Also, you know, when you do have a patient who dies, you know, you have to face the family and you know, explain to the family about the nature of the passing.
Right, and sometimes what happens, especially with patients who have that deep connection with their physician, is that they often tell the physician things they've never shared with anyone in their entire life.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is when my patients die, I'm holding the story of their life that they have not necessarily shared with other family members. And so that section on death, I do celebrate a lot of these stories that I publish with their family members' approval.
Okay.
About their deceased loved ones.
In your writing your book, did you intend to appeal to doctors or to patients, or both?
Both, but primarily it's for pre-med and medical students so that they realize they can actually graduate medical school and be that ideal physician that they described on their personal statement when they first applied to medical school. Often they forget who that person is through their training. But then I realized through writing the book that teenagers actually loved reading the book and that doctors enjoyed it too, and patients loved it because it gave them sort of an inside view to their doctor's heart and soul, something that they're often not privy to. So it's for everyone, I would say. And I've had 13 and up. I've had kids as young as 13 really love the book. And the cartoons make it very accessible.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And appealing. So. How did you manage to get Dr. Patch Adams to do the foreword in your book?
Oh, he's a good friend of mine. We date back many years, and I've spoken with him at conferences. So very sweet man and extremely creative in his approach to medical care. So, yeah, people have actually referred to me as the female Patch Adams. So I think we're on the same page and literally now in the book.
Literally.
So, yeah.
What made you decide to open your own practice?
You know, assembly line medicine is really demeaning and degrading to physicians and patients. So I was unwilling to hold myself or my patients hostage to a medical system that is not working. And therefore, I went ahead and put the patients in charge and held those town hall meetings and invited the community to design their ideal medical practice. I told them I would do anything they want as long as it's basically legal, you know. So it's a really fun clinic where patients love to come to the doctor. People even come early because they love to sit and read some of the literature that I have in the waiting area, but they really never have to wait because, honestly, if patients, you know, on occasion I might be late. If they have to wait more than 10 minutes, they get a gift.
What kind of literature do you have there?
Well, I have books that are inspiring by other physicians. I have this one, Kitchen Table Wisdom by Rachel Naomi Remen, that has very short chapters that, similar to my book, people really love to come and just read a chapter. It's kind of like a medical foreplay, you know, it gets you in a good mood before the doctor's visit instead of reading Good Housekeeping, where you maybe start thinking you need to clean your house or do something, you know, that's maybe not that inspiring to you. So I think people like to read relevant, inspiring health-related literature, and so it's just a very positive environment. And the clinic is located in a wellness center where people can take yoga classes, and there's a solar-heated indoor pool and a hot tub where people can come, and they can even wait in the hot tub before their visit.
Wow.
Imagine that.
Yeah, I guess so. In your book, you talk about your favorite prescriptions. All these sound unconventional. There's an inside message, I guess. What is it?
Well, the message is that people often need things that can't be prescribed in pill form. So what my job is when I'm sitting with a patient in that sacred moment where they are needing help for an issue and we're connecting physically, emotionally, spiritually, I really try to kind of get past even the words that they're speaking, and really think about, you know, what is the root of their problem? You know, what is it that's causing their depression or their fatigue or their hopelessness? You know, it could be that they're not in a relationship. It could be that they haven't taken a vacation in 3 years. And so I write prescriptions for, you know, a week-long vacation to the coast, or, you know, have your children massage your feet before bed, or find a girlfriend, or have great sex 3 times a week. These are all real prescriptions that I write for my patients. And they love them, and they hang them up at home. And one guy, I wrote him a prescription for a girlfriend, and the way I wrote
Did
it, his
one?
Name was actually... Not yet, but I always check. So the prescription, his name's Johnny, so I wrote, and he's actually in the book, I think chapter in the 80s somewhere, might be 88 or something. And I wrote the prescription. Johnny is a great guy, or he's a wonderful man. He's a wonderful man. He needs a great woman in his life. I highly recommend him. And he carries that around in his wallet just in case, you know, he meets a woman. He can pull that out. It's like a letter of recommendation from
letter
his doctor.
From a doctor. Let me ask you this. What was the most difficult concept for you to write about in this book?
The most difficult concept?
Yes.
To write about in the book. I don't think any of it was very difficult. It seemed to me the book was almost channeled. It was very easy to write. I wrote the entire book in 5 weeks. So it was just
it flowed.
Yeah, it just flowed. And I think what it was is for 20 years as an official medical doctor, not the doctor in training as a six-year-old. I mean, as a six-year-old, I was collecting stories as well. But since I've been an MD since 1993, I, over the last 20 years, have collected an amazing amount of stories, and it's almost, in a way, a burden to carry them around in isolation. So the book was actually a release.
You unloaded them in the book.
Yeah, I unloaded them in the book so they could be celebrated, you know, among many more people than just me kind of keeping them contained in my body all these years.
So what do you offer now in your practice that you didn't before?
You mean on the assembly line? What I was
well,
able
on,
to offer?
On the assembly line or off the assembly line.
In this particular practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, what I offer is a real relationship with a doctor. So the patients get 30 to 60 minute appointments, unless they have something very simple like strep throat or something that only takes, you know, 15. So there's never a rush. People can see me 24/7. I do house calls. They have access to me at any time. And, you know, we email, they're Facebook friends of mine if they want to be. And so it's just this accessible, real relationship. And what many people wrote on their testimony is that they wanted to feel like going to the doctor was sitting with their best friend, you know, kind of like going to their best friend's house, sitting in the living room with somebody who they've known for years, their best friend who happens to be a doctor.
Mm.
So that's the ambiance. And I don't think many people feel that way about their doctor, that they're best friends or that it's a very cozy living room type setting, you know. So
I can certainly see that.
Yeah. So that's what's different. And there's a lot of things that are different, but that would be what comes to mind first.
All right. You mentioned two rules to live by. What are they?
Two rules to live by. This is probably from a slideshow I did years ago. Is, let's see, you deserve to be happy. These are for doctors. Is that, you know, medicine shouldn't be a miserable profession, so you deserve to be happy as a doctor. And the other one is work within your means, meaning you don't need all this infrastructure like huge buildings and, you know, big computer systems and, you know, 13 employees per doctor if you're working at a humane speed. You know, an indication that you might be overworking is that you have 13 employees per doctor and you've got three rooms that you've got filled with patients and you're seeing a patient every 5 to 10 minutes. So work at a humane speed. And I think that goes for everyone. You know, we all deserve to be happy in our professions, and we all should be working. Just because we have gadgets that allow us to do 12 things at once doesn't mean we should be doing 12 things at once. So these gadgets are supposed to make our life easier and, you know, more meaningful, not necessarily speed us up to the point of insanity.
So you want to slow down and be human.
Yeah, I think that's what people want when they go to the doctor. They want to feel like they're connecting with somebody and actually having a healing experience, not being rushed through like a widget on an assembly line.
You say that doctors and patients are subjected to frustrations. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, the frustration is just having all these third parties that have been invited into the room. It's kind of like, you know, when you're married and you want to just be alone in your bedroom with your spouse, but you're not really sure why your CPA is there and your, you know, medical assistant and the nurse and the coder and the biller. And you're just kind of wondering, like, when you're going to get to spend time alone with the person that you want to be with.
Yeah.
You know, meaning patients and physicians deserve to have that uninterrupted time together. And because there's so many actual third parties in the room, either physically or you feel their presence, you know, they've inserted themselves into the medical profession where they don't belong. And so as a result, what would be a beautiful healing relationship is tormented and taxed to the point where the doctors sometimes aren't making enough with these government programs to even sustain their practices, and patients are upset, you know, financially, because all their money is going to pay all these other people, and the beauty of the relationship has disappeared.
And they're like barriers. They're
right.
Really.
It's like a, you know, when you have 13 staff per doctor, that's like a human shield of 13 people that's keeping, you know, the patient away from that connection. They want to, you know, they just want to ask a simple question like, how much vitamin D should I take? Or what did you say to do with that prescription? And you have to go through 13 people in a phone tree, you know, human shield.
Mm.
It's ridiculous. It's not healthcare.
Well, maybe some doctors feel protected in some way, or, you know, I don't know.
Well, protected in a detached sort of way.
In a detached way, exactly.
I mean, it perpetuates that detached patriarchal model of medicine in which, you know, the, you know, person comes in with the white coat and is like God and comes in for 5 minutes and then runs off and you can't connect with them emotionally or spiritually. And, you know, sometimes you actually look in their eyes and it looks like nobody's home. You know, they're not present, even for themselves.
I think Captain Picard, Star Trek, was the one who said that if you want to be a captain, if you want to be a leader, you have to take risks.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that's, you need to, you know, expose yourself a little bit too.
Right, you need to be vulnerable and real.
Be vulnerable, exactly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So how is your approach to certain health problems now differ compared to when you were first a medical student?
Oh, my approach has probably always been the same because I'm the type of person that likes to connect with my patients. I just wasn't given the opportunity to bring my approach to fruition at every 10 minutes seeing patients because they're just... You know, the time limitations were made it challenging. And the way I described this recently on another interview is this is the way a patient would understand what it's like for a doctor. Now, most doctors who go, you know, students who go into medicine, they want to be humanitarian healers. I mean, it's not generally their goal is not to make money. If you want to make money, there's a lot easier ways to make money. People do this because it's a calling. Especially in primary care medicine, you know, internal medicine, family practice. And so, you know, in order to provide that type of service, you need to connect with your patients. Now, these physicians are essentially perfectionist, obsessive, compulsive individuals. You know, mm-hmm. That's the personality of a physician. And what it's like to see 30 patients a day, it's like somebody's handing you 30 really great novels and you only get to chapter one or two in each one before they're ripped away and they send you to the next room with the next book, where you get to dive in to the point where you start to enjoy it and then you're ripped away and you go to the next room. It's a very dissatisfying way of
but that's
of
a very good analogy.
People. What?
That's a very good analogy.
Yeah. And you can only imagine how painful this is for a perfectionist.
Yeah, I guess so, yes.
Yeah. And so that, you know, patients often don't look at it from the physician's point of view. They just think that their appointment didn't go so well, or they get frustrated and mad at the doctor, but the doctor's trying their best. Oh, in this really insane system. So what was your question? I missed it.
The question was, how has your approach to certain health problems now differed compared to
when
first...
Yeah, it's not any different. It's different than many other doctors because we're not taught to do this, but this is kind of innately how I practice medicine, is that I, again, like to connect with people emotionally, physically, spiritually. Sometimes their physical problems are manifestations of emotional or spiritual disease. So, for example, I had a 16-year-old who came in and she was having frequent urination. Now, in the average clinic, she would just be sent for a urinalysis. You know, they'd check it out and, you know, maybe give her antibiotics or call it a urinary tract infection. But I listened to her and asked her, you know, well, when did this start? Turns out it started when her she was living with her dad at the time, who then moved in with his girlfriend. So now she's living at the girlfriend's house with her father in a detached garage sort of thing, not even in the main house. And so she said as soon as she moved there, that's when it started. And it only happens in the evening when she's at home. It doesn't happen at school or at her friend's house. And so I said, well, what is it like living there? She said, it's really uncomfortable because they're arguing all the time. And I told her, I never examined her. She doesn't, you know, the urine wasn't foul-smelling. She said there was no blood in there. It didn't burn when she peed. She was just peeing a lot, you know, every hour or two having to go to the bathroom. I said, you know, what you need to do is just speak your truth. And I wrote that as a prescription. I said, if an adult is making you uncomfortable, you need to speak up because your bladder, you know, you're pissed off, basically. Your bladder.
Literally.
Yeah, literally pissed off. And so she went home and she told her dad, I'm pissed off with you. And her bladder problems went away. You know, and I never touched her. I never made her pee into a cup, you know, I never did a urinalysis. All I did was listen to her. And I think that's what a lot of people need, is somebody with curiosity to listen to them. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't need another MRI or another lab test.
All right. What touched you most in writing this fun and entertaining book?
What touched me most
what reached into your soul? What captured your essence?
It's just how deep you can go with patients, how some patients will trust you as their physician more than anyone else in the world, and they will be more faithful to you than anyone else in the world, even their spouse. They will be more honest with you, and it's actually an amazing sort of transcendent relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I've told many of my patients before they've died to keep in touch with me, and they wink and know what I'm talking about, and they do. I feel their presence after their death. I think that's amazing. When a lot of people just pick a doctor out of a list given to them by their insurance company, but, you know, this is the most important relationship of your life. This is somebody who could write a prescription that will kill you tomorrow or do something that will save your life. This might be the last person's face you see before you die. And I think it's kind of strange that people just randomly pick some doctor from a list and they don't have that depth of a relationship with somebody who could be such a healing force in their life or such a potentially disastrous force in their life, right? So that really touches me, and it's amazing that when I make the commitment to be there for a patient, it actually continues beyond their death, and that our relationship deepens even after they disappear in physical form. I don't know how to explain this any other way.
You're doing a very good job.
I mean, I know people who've been married for a long time, and if they lose a partner, they might feel a presence of that person with them even after their partner passes. I mean, I've heard these stories from other people. It's just you don't generally think of doctors and patients having that type of relationship.
That special connection, yeah.
Right. And often that, if both people are vulnerable and honest, like this type of connection can happen among lots of different people. It's just that our medical system has been dumbed down to this cookbook numbers game, you know, with algorithms and flow charts, and it's very mechanized and industrialized that people forget that this beautiful relationship exists and is actually supposed to be the foundation of the whole healthcare system.
Well, I mean, I certainly remember it as a child, you know, going to a doctor. It was a very different experience than it is today.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be. I mean, people can have that if they want it.
So you're really calling for going back to an earlier era.
Yeah, I'm calling for people to ask what they want and to demand what they deserve and not to put up with substandard treatment. You know, you don't deserve to be sitting in a waiting room for an hour longer after your appointment. You know, if your appointment's at 3, you should be seen sometime around 3 o'clock. You know, it's disrespectful to leave you there till 4 or 5. I've met people who've waited, like one woman told me she was waiting 6 hours for an appointment. And this doesn't need to be normal.
Yeah,
you know?
And not only that, but in some offices, isn't it possible that sometimes receptionists kind of lose track of what's going on and people get forgotten altogether? I've known people that have been in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, when you're moving at an inhumane speed, you start doing things that are inhumane, you know, and you're not able to create a warm, loving, nurturing environment, which is what people request when you ask them what an ideal medical clinic is. You know, they want to leave feeling warm, nurtured, loved, and important. How many people do you think leave the average medical clinic in this country feeling warm, nurtured, loved, and important?
Not too many.
Yeah, and that's totally unnecessary. They could all leave feeling that way. You know, one thing that a friend of mine told me on the phone that was just so funny that ended up, I turned it into a YouTube news story, and then it was picked up by ABC World News Tonight, and Diane Sawyer reported it 2 years ago. But she just, in passing, because I asked her, I mean, she wanted to know, I hadn't talked to her in 3 years, she wanted to know what I was up to, and I said, you know, I'm leading town hall meetings and letting patients design their own clinics and hospitals even, and she found that fascinating, and she's a real go-getter type of person, and she doesn't... If she feels disrespected, she speaks up. And what happens with her, she told me, because I said I'm always looking for new ideas for physicians and how we can have healthcare really be about health and care. And she said, well, what frustrates me at doctor's offices is that I have to wait. And she said, I decided to stop being frustrated and do something about it. I said, what did you do? And she said, well, I billed the doctor for my waiting time. She actually, at her hourly rate, she was working at Boeing at the time as a consultant, so her hourly rate was $47 an hour, and that's what she billed her physicians at that rate, and they actually paid her for her waiting room time.
Wow.
I thought that was great. You know, and honestly, if everyone stood up tomorrow and billed for their waiting time, when they're, you know, delayed beyond a reasonable amount of time. I'm not asking people to do this after 30 minutes, you know, before 30 minutes or something. Obviously, there's a little leeway there. Or if you're seeing an obstetrician and you know they're off delivering a baby, you know, that's kind of built into certain practices. But your dermatologist or, you know, does it happen every time when you see your doctor who's not a surgeon? You know, so
yeah, patients' time is worth something too.
Yeah, that's worth something too. And if just imagine if every patient today stood up and billed their doctor for their waiting time in excess of an hour or something, you know, we'd have healthcare reform tomorrow. You wouldn't need DC to do much. Don't you think?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
yeah. I mean
it sounds logical.
Right. Yeah, so it's just a matter of people demanding the respect they deserve. And certainly in healthcare, I mean, it's one thing if you're at a car repair shop, you know, the car repair shop isn't there to make you feel loved,
warm,
nurtured,
important.
It's not
a personal thing. Right.
They're there to repair your car.
To repair your car.
You know, you're going to healthcare to feel better, to feel like a real person, to be healed, to leave loved, nurtured, warm, and important. That's the last place on earth you should be feeling disrespected and leave feeling worse than you did when you came in, or more uncertain than you did when you came in.
Yeah, that doesn't.
Or more scared.
To feel worse after you visit a doctor.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. That's not what healthcare is about. But yet, I think, what do you think? You think a lot of people leave their visits feeling worse than when they came in?
Some might, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
more scared or uncertain or...
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. I can see that because, you know, as you said, a lot of the impersonality of it, you know, that... you feel very much on the outside looking in.
Right. And I did a survey where I asked people to define the word healthcare, and people were coming up with, you know, I just went up and down the street with my tape recorder in various cities and said, what's healthcare?
And
the responses were amazing, you know, like a paper trail, get a prescription, you know, something you can never afford. And it was healthcare, the words themselves are very beautiful. Health is a beautiful word by nature. Care is a beautiful word. But combined, they have been so demeaned and degraded by this country, by what we've offered people.
What about compared to other countries, like, for example, in Europe and especially in the Scandinavia, where we have socialized medicine?
Well, I think people have more access to care in these countries, and depending on the country, they might actually get that relationship. Like I heard in, you know, small towns in Greece, you know, they still have the doctor. They walk down the street to their, you know, neighborhood doctor who's known their family for years, and so they do get that relationship that's so essential. But you know, I just got an email this morning from a physician in the UK who said, because I also am very concerned about the high physician suicide rate here. We lost 3 physicians to suicide in 18 months in my town. And, you know, just here in Oregon.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a really shock. And both men that I dated in medical school died by suicide. Both the medical students after they graduated. As physicians, they died by suicide. And so physician suicide is a huge problem, which, again, is an indicator that...
That's news to me. I didn't know that.
Most people don't know, and believe me, most doctors don't like to talk about it. One is that we're not culturally, we're not very comfortable in America talking about death, okay? And physicians,
for starters,
surprisingly, are not very comfortable talking about death either. And we don't learn anything about it in medical school. You know, when death happens, that's when we'll move on to the next topic.
So it's like a taboo topic.
Yeah, it's a taboo topic in general and in medicine. And then suicide is just death in your face, you know, unexpectedly, suddenly in your face. And so that's not a very popular topic either among in our culture generally or among physicians. And physician suicide, wow, those are the people you're supposed to go to when you need help. Oh, they're committing suicide too? That's really an unpopular topic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like
a triple taboo topic. I don't like it.
Yeah, and so the thing is that physician suicide is happening at higher rates in other countries too. You know, like the UK. Like this. You know, I got an email just this morning before I got on the phone with you from a physician who essentially said, you know, he's lost a number of colleagues from suicide in the UK, and it's the same situation there. They're on an assembly line, that whole production line model, that industrialized medical model.
Even with socialized medicine.
Well, socialized medicine just means more people have access to their doctors. It doesn't mean their services are any better.
All right.
You know what I mean? Socialized, or, you know, a lot of these, you know, programs, right? They're all... like even our Obamacare, that's really health insurance reform. That's not health care reform. What that does is put more people on health insurance, does nothing to really help them get the services they might need in the way they'd like to receive them. That's never discussed. It's just now you have a card and you pay money and you can see the doctor. Now, what happens when you and the doctor, good luck, okay? That could be anything. That could be a service that made you feel worse. That could be a relationship that could be a doctor who feels suicidal. I mean, that whole piece isn't dealt with. So it's the same thing in other countries, even though everyone has access to the doctor. In some other countries where medicine is socialized, it still could feel like an assembly line where you're feeling like a number. And, you know, granted, you might get your MRI, and that's great, and maybe you couldn't get it here, but maybe you didn't need the MRI. Maybe you needed a week-long vacation. You know, maybe you didn't need a urinalysis. Maybe you needed to tell your dad you were pissed off, you know?
Or you had to pee in a cup.
Yeah. I mean, that sort of thing may or may not happen in other countries. You know, just because you have an insurance card doesn't guarantee you health care, the type of care that you really need. And, yeah, the physician suicide piece is a really big reminder that things aren't working.
Yeah. The thing that comes to mind when I think of Obamacare is I think of the penalties you get for not getting health insurance. That, according to the Obamacare, there's a penalty built into that.
Oh, yeah, the penalties for not participating in for-profit health care. Yeah.
So I don't get that, because if you can't afford to get private health care, then how can you afford to pay a penalty?
Yeah, I understand that.
It's kind of a contradiction.
Yeah, and that's why they have subsidies. And, I mean, who knows how this is actually all going to work out in the end for individuals.
All 5,000 pages of it.
We'll find out. But, yeah, there are a lot of people in my town who don't plan to get health insurance because they're morally against the whole idea of for-profit health care. So they're not going to pay into that.
And it's expensive.
And it's expensive, yeah.
So what advice can you give to startup doctors that you didn't have as a startup doctor?
Well, the advice would be to remember what you wrote on your medical school application, on your personal statement. I've given this advice recently to several medical students who tell me, you know, they become cynical within their first week or month of medical school, and you wonder, you know, gee, what happened? You were so excited before. And I ask them what they wrote on their personal statement, and they tell me these beautiful things that they want to do as a physician. And I remind them, well, I say, well, how much are you paying for your tuition? And they tell me, like, $50,000 a year. So I remind them, look, you're paying. They accepted you at this medical school based on your application and your beautiful personal statement. So what you're doing, let me remind you, is you're paying $50,000 a year to learn a skill set so that you can actually be the doctor that you wrote on your personal statement. You're not paying $50,000 a year to get talked out of the doctor that you want to be on your personal statement. You're paying money to learn a skill set to be that person. So don't forget that. And, you know, it's just amazing. The big problem in medicine is just the level of cynicism, depression, and, you know, that leads to the suicide, but the burnout, cynicism, and depression. These are the doctors, the older doctors who are cynical and jaded, are teaching the next generation. So the next generation is inheriting this cynicism and despair. So the advice that I would give to young physicians starting out is that you don't have to have a lifetime of despair and cynicism in medicine. You can live your dreams. You can be the doctor that you described on your personal statement. Don't let anyone convince you that you can't.
All right, I won't.
You know?
So why has medicine changed so much since the days of house calls and family doctors?
I think it's just the third parties that have inserted themselves, including the government, and the pressure and regulation that comes as a result of all these layers and layers of bureaucracy and rules and, you know, all sorts of things that we have to follow that don't necessarily serve the doctor or the patient, but sustain this system. Yeah, it's a big burden.
You mentioned rules and rules. It seems to me that the rules keep doubling and doubling and increasing every year. I mean, all you have to do is go back 100 years ago. Yeah, exponentially.
Yeah.
All you have to do is go back 100 years ago, and there are very few rules that government had for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have all these rules and rules on top of rules and rules inside of rules and sub-rules, and it's endless.
So it is.
Where do you think it'll end? I mean, or will it end?
Oh, it won't end until people stand up and say they're not going to go for another layer of rules. I mean, just
that sounds like revolution.
Well, but it can be peaceful. It doesn't have to be,
violent.
But, you know, even our codes, we have to code a medical visit. There's this book called the ICD-9 Book of Codes, and you're supposed to, oh my Lord, it's got, I don't know, it's so thick. It's thicker than like two phone books put together for like, you know, for Dallas, Texas, you know, it's thick. And then, and now they're increasing it to you have to learn this ICD-10 code book that has something like 10 or 20 times more codes because they want us to code. Originally, now, let me just tell you, if you came in with foot pain, I could code that as foot pain. You know, it could be 729.5. Okay, and the insurance company would know you came in with foot pain. Now, this next code book, you're going to have to put a special code if it's right foot pain, left foot pain, if it involves a certain toe, if it doesn't involve a certain toe. I mean, the number's going to go on and on and on, and they're going to want every detail
more
of your life.
Specificity.
And you know how much time that takes?
Yeah, sure.
It's
sure,
just ridiculous.
Deciding how to categorize something. Sure.
I mean, they want to, like, this is part of the problem of this patriarchal reductionist model, right, is that they think that the answers are in reducing things into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces, and pulling people apart, you know, to that level is really disintegrating. That, I mean, we want to go back to a holistic
But that makes it into a manufacturing process.
Yeah, right, it does.
Small pieces.
It does, yeah. And what I wanted to say
it's
about...
like a factory.
It is, yeah. It's like a factory. And the best comment that I got when I was interviewing people about what the definition of healthcare is actually came from a man in a grocery store in Oregon. He told me healthcare is a return to wholeness. Okay, so that's how people want to feel, a return to wholeness. And he said he hasn't been to a doctor in years because every time he goes to a doctor, he feels pieced apart. He feels less whole when he leaves.
Do you think there's a real chance that we might return to the old-fashioned doctor-patient relationship?
Oh, definitely. More and more doctors are actually quitting these unsustainable, large, you know, big box clinics and going back into these smaller practices that can deliver that humane and beautiful care that people are looking for, which is actually cheaper, by the way. You know,
yeah.
I mean, how much money did I have to spend to tell the woman that she just needed to tell her father she's pissed off instead of doing a urinalysis? You know, a lot of stuff, I mean, it just doesn't cost anything to explain to somebody what's going on with their body versus ordering the CT scan. A lot of times when people get these tests, their doctor never calls them back with the results. And they're
sitting there
for weeks wondering, you know, what did that MRI show?
Yeah,
and the doctor will write back and say
it.
Everything's normal, but their stomach pain is still there. And they never get the explanation.
Yeah.
Isn't that wild? It would be so much easier to explain what the likely cause of their stomach pain was when they were there in person versus ordering the test and not calling them back.
So the irony here is, with all this, the good things you're saying here, how did the medical profession get away from this individual practice?
How it went astray is that physicians were essentially manipulated and controlled by external forces. I think a lot of doctors, especially if you think about the old town, you know, rural doctor who, you know, delivered babies and did house calls and all that stuff. I mean, medicine was such a labor of love, you know, maybe 100 years ago or something, 60 years ago. People weren't in it for the money. They were in it to, you know, return to their hometown and be the family hometown doctor, right? And so all these other forces inserted themselves, like you know, they manipulated doctors like people are generally easy to manipulate. You know, insurance companies will come in and say, or HMOs or whatever, and say, look, it all started with Medicare, actually, in 1965. Medicare came in, and then it was very interesting. There was an incentive to I guess, see more patients and bill the government, right? So people could make a lot of money, I think, early on with Medicare. So it kind of perverted the relationship because then you weren't really asking the patient to pay. You were asking this third party to pay. So there was this potential for doctors to overcharge a third party but not hurt their patient. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course.
And so
it makes sense.
You know, anytime you remove something from the relationship, from the direct relationship you're having with your patient, it creates some really perverse incentives. So, yeah, then doctors got like, oh, wow, cash cow, you know, you could really make a lot of money from billing the government, right? And then these other companies came and they're like, okay, well, now what we have to do, because things are more complicated even with just adding Medicare. Things became more complicated because then you had to do, you know, billing forms and you had to track things a little differently. You couldn't just keep everything on your index cards like doctors were used to. Like my dad had all his patients' charts on little index cards on his desk. And so then these bigger organizations like, you know, HMOs would come and say, look, if you don't want to have to handle all this administrative burden, leave it to us. Work for us, you know, the larger medical group, because small doctors are going out of business. And, you know, and they convince them that their life would be easier to join with a group. And then what happens, of course, is they control the speed of your treadmill. And as soon as you sign on the dotted line, they've doubled your speed. Now you know what I mean? You're moving faster than you were before, and your life isn't really better, okay? And so just piece by piece by piece, these third parties inserted themselves where they don't belong. Because honestly, a doctor from years ago wouldn't turn an older patient away. They would just be seen for free or discount or do trade or bring eggs or, you know what I mean? If you're like a small-town doctor, believe me, like doctors are generally very ethical people. And so it's only from these perverse incentives and this dumbing down and loss of this relationship that they've been able to behave in ways that are inhumane. You know what I mean? It just all trickles down. So, yeah.
I could certainly see that.
The simple answer is just these third parties have, you know, like I said, the sacred relationship between you and your wife, how many other people do you want in your bedroom with you at night?
Yeah, nobody else.
And then you're paying them. You know, you're paying them to be there, and they're in your way.
You're paying.
Can you imagine getting up in the middle of the night and your CPA is lying between you and your wife? What are they doing there?
Besides enjoying the refreshing prognosis, if you will, of a doctor and patient relationship, what other values can the readers gain from pet goats and pap smears?
Well, there's a lot of laughter there. So it's just, it's a fun book if you like to laugh, okay? And then underneath the laughter, it's like, I guess you call it edutainment, right? You're being educated, kind of sneakily educated through these basically sort of simple stories of medical adventures that other people have had. Like, for example, teenagers love the book because there's a lot of stories. I have a sex worker patient who's got a chapter in there. Now, you can learn a lot through her medical adventures without having to become a sex worker yourself or without having to get gonorrhea yourself, right? So by reading other people's medical adventures, you learn things without being lectured. See what I'm saying?
Sure.
So I think people, especially teenagers, love that. And then I write it in such a way, again, that it's accessible to kids as young as 13. Yet let me tell you, adults in their 60s are learning new things. Like, I don't know if you saw the chapter, A Tale of Two Testicles. Did you make it to that chapter? You didn't?
Oh, I love that title.
Okay, well, I'll have to tell you briefly what happened. In A Tale of Two Testicles, this policeman, a retired police officer, comes in. He's like close to 60 years old, and he's very upset, and he's, you know, basically freaking out, and I'm thinking there's an emergency. And we go into the exam room, and he pulls his pants down and points to his left testicle. Okay, I got my exam gloves on. I turn on the light, and I'm leaning in real close. You know, I'm like a few inches from his testicle. And I'm asking, what? What's going on? And he said, look, doc, can't you see? What? He goes, my left testicle, it's hanging real low. And I said, there's no pain? And he said, no pain. I said, it's just hanging low? He said, yeah, look how low it is. Okay, I stood up and I told him, look, most people hang lower on the left. In women, the left breast is usually larger and hangs slightly lower than the right. In men, the left testicle usually hangs a little lower than the right, so you're in with the main crowd. So the guy's
asymmetry.
Yeah, right. He's totally relieved. He gives me his copay and a $5 tip, and on his way out the office, I tell him, just so you know, most curvy penises also curve to the left. And these are just basic things that actually
sure.
people stay up at night and worry about, and they think there's something wrong with them.
Yeah.
And nowhere is this taught. You know, I have told so many people over and over again, one-on-one in medical clinics, the same thing. It's so much easier to write it as a story, you know, that would be available
oh,
for
yeah.
mass
stories are
consumption.
Mm-hmm.
Because people need to get more familiar with themselves and
yeah.
realize that they're normal. You know, and there's nothing to worry about. So that's just an example of what readers can get when they read the book, is they might understand their bodies at a level that they haven't understood before. And then they might not make certain mistakes in their behaviors that would lead to certain diseases. And these are all embedded in hilarious stories. And the stories
yeah.
are only, like you saw, 1 to 3 pages each. So
mm-hmm.
really great bathroom
reading. Like anecdotes.
Yeah, little anecdotes. Yeah, with funny cartoons.
So, will this book bring a better understanding between doctors and patients, you think?
Yeah, I think it will reconnect both parties.
Reconnect. Yeah.
Yeah, with each other and with their individual and collective humanity. You know, I think, honestly, the culture that we have, because we have these gadgets that can do 12 things at once, we've sort of, honestly, forgotten how to be human.
Yeah.
We spend a lot of time moving really fast and accomplishing lots of things, and then, you know, we've turned off our emotions because to feel some of the pain is too much, so a lot of people are numb during the day. When you turn your emotions off, you also disconnect from your body. You don't necessarily pick up subtle sensations in your body that could
mm-hmm.
be indicators of disease,
sure.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're living this very detached life, very cerebral, and not very emotional, spiritual, or even physical in our bodies, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So because we've become, as a culture, sort of robotic, and our doctors have certainly become robotic, again, this
yeah.
is the downfall of a patriarchal reductionist medical model that industrializes
uh-huh.
human services. You know, again, it could work in a Toyota plant. You could produce great cars on a production line with an industrialized model, right? But
sure.
in human services, this sort of mechanized approach does not work because we're human, right? In order
yeah,
to
right,
be human,
exactly.
we need to sure. move at a human pace, at a human scale. You know, at the medical library in the hospital, I was really appalled because I'm one of those people that loves to go to the library and read those big textbooks. And I was looking through in between, let's see, where was it? It was around urology, between RST, between renal and urology. I saw this book on Toyota manufacturing. I was like, what is this doing in the library at the hospital? I pulled it out, and actually they're trying to follow, I guess, Toyota manufacturing. They have these lean methods, and they're really great at production. And they actually try to use the same methods in healthcare. I mean, it's known in among healthcare administrators. They quote these Toyota people all the time. So if you ever feel like you're kind of just ending up getting your muffler changed and you didn't really get the type of service you wanted, it might be because they're following an assembly line auto plant model of healthcare.
Very important question. Where can someone buy this wonderful book and get more information about you and keep up with your professional growth?
Well, they can go to petgoatsandpapsmears.com, and you can also see videos of the goat wandering around my office with the patients, which is really funny. If you click on videos, and of course it's on Amazon, and
uh-huh.
you know, through petgoatsandpapsmears.com, they can contact me, and I'm happy to lead town halls in your neighborhood, happy to help you open your own clinic, happy to do whatever you need me to do. I return all my emails, and so feel free to be in touch with me.
By the way, we're coming to the end of the show, and since our show is about people, family, and life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Yes, a recipe for living. I think there's two that come to mind. The first recipe for living, which is an actual recipe, is when you see your doctor, you might consider that a recipe from your kitchen would actually be the best solution to your medical problem. Like the top three causes of death in the country, heart disease and cancer and stroke, actually have huge relationships to diet and lifestyle. So I actually do prescribe kale smoothies for patients, which could sound disgusting, but it is, you know, like banana, apple with a little few leaves of kale in there. You can put whatever other types of fruit. But essentially these green smoothies, which people might read about online, and I think they're becoming more popular, they actually work really well for reducing cholesterol and your stroke risk and decreasing your risk of cancer. So that would be the first actual recipe. The second bigger comprehensive recipe I have for people is to consider really investing in the relationships in your life. And that's relationships with your doctor, relationships with your loved ones, you know, being fully present with yourself. How about a relationship with yourself? I wrote a prescription for somebody to fall in love with yourself. Okay? So because in order to be really in a relationship with somebody else, you need to first be in a relationship with yourself.
Sure.
And many people have forgotten how to do that or are living, you know, in this detached, robotic way. So the big secret here, the recipe for life is to be in a relationship with yourself and do not be afraid and actually welcome being in relationships with everyone around you. Yeah, from the cab driver to your doctor, you know, to
your spouse.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Weibel, I want to thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. And to all our listeners, thank you for being here and sharing part of Dr. Weibel's life with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be George Stranahan. George and I will be discussing his latest book, A Predicament of Innocence, Might the Schools Help? Having been a photographer and progressive educator for 56 years, George will be taking us on a pictorial journey of a provocative collection of essays and photographs of local school children exploring the art of teaching the minds of children and how the current educational infrastructure stifles the growth of both. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. And Dr. Weibel, thank you again and have a great day.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
My pleasure.